Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Jed Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, and recorded before a live audience. The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald is a revered classic and a rite of passage in the reading lives of millions. However, book critic and author Maureen Corrigan says while Gatsby may be one of the most popular novels in America, she believes many of us first read it and read it when we are too young to fully comprehend its power. In her new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be Written and Why It Endures, Corrigan offers a fresh perspective on what makes Gatsby great and utterly unusual. Maureen Corrigan is the book critic for NPR's Fresh Air, the critic in residence at Georgetown University, which is one of the cooler titles I've ever heard, and winner of the Edgar Award for Criticism. It is a great pleasure. I hope you will join me in welcoming Maureen Corrigan to this week's Book Show. It's wonderful having you here. I have to say that I learned, and I think you mentioned this in your book, that you have read The Great Gatsby like 50 times.
At least, yeah.
So here's the way I work this out in my mind. The first time you were assigned it, the second time you revisited it, mm-hmm. and then the third time you actually wanted to read it because you enjoyed it.
You have to slide in there, I had to teach it. Having to teach a book is the greatest way to sort of stop and say, all right, what do other people see in this book? Why do I have to teach it? And I would say that by the third time, I was knocked out, which is what happened to America in the late 40s and 50s. The second time America read Gatsby, so to speak, it was bowled over. We were bowled over as Americans. The first time when Gatsby came out in 1925, it got mixed reviews. Famous headline in the New York World of a review, Fitzgerald's latest, a dud.
It comes out, it gets lukewarm reviews from the press.
From the press, yeah.
Literary folk generally liked it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fitzgerald's friends, Gertrude Stein, thought it was a masterpiece. In fact, she alienated herself with Ernest Hemingway by telling Ernest Hemingway that Fitzgerald was the real deal. Hemingway was sort of a second rater. They were never the same again. T.S. Eliot read it three times in 1925. Other names that are not as familiar, Gilbert Seldes, who was a critic at the time, wrote a beautiful review in the Dial magazine, which T.S. Eliot was involved in. And I keep coming back to Hemingway because he was such a, what's a word I can say on radio? He was such a creep. When this amazing review of The Great Gatsby came out, written by Gilbert Seldes in 1925 in the Dial magazine, Hemingway says to Fitzgerald, "Too bad about that review." And Fitzgerald's, "What?" He says, "Yeah, too bad about that review. Once you get a review like that, it ruins you for any other book you try to write." You know, so Hemingway, you always get the sense when you read his letters, when you read about the relationship, especially between these two men, that Hemingway knew where people's soft spots were. And when he felt threatened, he went for them.
One of the things that, one of the reasons I love your book so much is because I learned that the old adage, you can't judge a book by its cover, which is iconic. And one of the things that I found out in reading your book that I did not know, that this was done by Xavier Cugat's brother. The band leader, Xavier Cugat, this was the jacket was done by his brother.
Another way to say that, Joe, is that it was done by Charo's brother-in-law, right? But her brother-in-law.
That's right.
And Charo's, you have to be of a certain age to get that reference, but it's really unsettling. Yeah, you know, one
unsettling. That's a good way of
one of
it.
The things I tried to consider, because this book is Some of it is literary criticism, some of it is biography of Fitzgerald and how he wrote Gatsby, and some of it is, on my part, first person memoir.
Right.
You know, I get about 200 books a week delivered to my house from publishers hoping that they'll get a review on Fresh Air. And most times I don't really pay that much attention to the cover. Once in a while, a cover will grab me and I'll open up a book because of the cover. I tried to think, would I have reviewed The Great Gatsby? It was Fitzgerald's third novel. He was known for writing about flappers and philosophers. It's thin. It doesn't have the greatest title. Fitzgerald was never happy with the title. He could never arrive at the great title. Would I have even opened it up? Or would I have said, another Fitzgerald? I think the cover would have grabbed me. That iconic cover of the flapper's face floating in the night sky over the lights of an amusement park, a Coney Island landscape. It's so odd that I think I would have opened the book, and then Nick Carraway's voice would have grabbed me.
So the book comes back. It has a resurgence after World War II, and it's a second life.
Yeah. Fitzgerald, when he died in Hollywood in 1940, his last royalty check was for $13.13. Makes some of us feel good sometimes when looking at our royalty checks, but horrible. Oh, and that $13.13 represented the books he bought himself that he gave to his friends because he couldn't get his own books in bookstores. As you say, it was essentially he was out of print. I mean, technically, people quibble about this. There were moldering copies of The Great Gatsby in Scribner's warehouse upon Fitzgerald's death. During World War II, there's this amazing program that I didn't know that much about before I began researching my book, in which publishers, paper distributors, authors, editors, librarians, they get together in New York during the war, and they want to do something for the war effort. They come up with this idea to print cheap paperback editions of over 1,000 titles, everything from Moby Dick to the latest Rex Stout mystery, Coming of Age in Samoa by Margaret Mead. I mean, you can't believe these titles that they're printing. A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. And they're called Armed Services Editions. The Great Gatsby was chosen in 1945 to be one of these Armed Services Editions. So the book goes from, you know, decaying in Scribner's warehouse to 155,000 copies of The Great Gatsby distributed to sailors, soldiers. These editions were meant to be read seven times before they fell apart. 1949, we get a second Gatsby movie starring Alan Ladd. The first movie was 1926. It was a silent film, and we only have the trailer. The trailer looks fabulous. I'll just tell you one other thing about that whole idea of who plays Gatsby and what Gatsby looks like. When Fitzgerald was working on The Great Gatsby, Max Perkins writes him a letter and says, I don't know, I can't see Gatsby. Tom Buchanan is fabulous. What a great character. Gatsby, I can't quite grasp. A few weeks pass, and Fitzgerald writes back to Max Perkins and says, I've had Zelda draw pictures of Gatsby until her fingers are practically falling off. I think I can see him now. Where are those sketches? Mm. Anybody want to write a literary mystery? I mean, yeah, wouldn't that be a find?
Originally, this was perceived as a crime novel.
Yeah. Well, reviewers of the time talked about it as a crime novel. And when you think about it, we've got three violent deaths. We've got a main character who makes his fortune as in bootlegging. I mean, he could have been a robber baron or something else. No, it's bootlegging. We've got characters like Meyer Wolfsheim, who's modeled after Arnold Rothstein, who, by taking this little tour of your museum here in town in Saratoga Springs, as I did this afternoon, I see Arnold Rothstein had something to do with gambling in Saratoga too. But he was the guy who supposedly fixed the 1919 World Series, the Black Sox scandal. That's who's in the world of this novel, along with a lot of drinking, partying, extramarital sex. Reviewers of the time took it as a crime novel. I don't think they're wrong about that. I just think that they, of course, didn't read what else was going on in the novel. And then you think about Jay Gatsby's name. A gat is 20 slang for a gun. You know, Fitzgerald is, he's part of that generation of American writers like Hemingway, like H.L. Mencken. They're trying to get American speech and slang into their work, into their short stories and novels, to wrest American fiction away from the British. So it's all there. It's just that that's not the only thing that's there. And the reviewers really focused on the crime.
You talk in your book, and we have spoken about Fitzgerald's time in Hollywood. Mm. And I'm hoping you can read from your chapter of that time and a story that is told in the book.
The Hollywood years of Fitzgerald are mostly so sad because he thought he was a failure. And he's working for the studio in Hollywood, the studio system. So they're putting him on different films and then pulling him off. You know, he's basically put to work to make scripts better. He worked for 2 weeks on Gone with the Wind before he was pulled off of Gone with the Wind. So this is a story about his time in Hollywood, the end of his time in Hollywood. There's a story about those Hollywood years that I can't get out of my head. Shortly after he met Sheila Graham in 1937, Fitzgerald read in the paper that the Pasadena Playhouse was presenting a stage adaptation of his short story, The Diamond As Big as the Ritz. Fitzgerald decided to put on the dog. He called the Playhouse, announced that he was the author, and reserved 2 seats. He also reserved a chauffeured limousine and took Sheila in evening clothes out to dinner and on to the theater. When they arrived, no one was in the lobby. It turned out that some students were performing the play in an upstairs hall. The upstairs hall was pretty empty too, just about a dozen or so casually dressed people, mostly the players' mothers, it seemed, in the audience. Afterward, Fitzgerald went backstage to congratulate the student players, later telling Sheila they were nice kids. I told them they'd done a good job. Anyone who loves Fitzgerald can't help but wish that he could have had a glimpse into the future. Just a couple of decades beyond his own death, he would have seen crowds of students, much like those Pasadena amateur actors, reading The Great Gatsby in college and high school classrooms. Further on, he would have seen several more Gatsby films, the operas, the ballet, and Gats, the 7-hour off-Broadway production that I saw twice, which is fantastic. He would have seen volumes of criticism and biographies towering in piles big as the Ritz, and he would have seen the money, how he would have loved the money. But Fitzgerald saw none of that. In May of 1940, Fitzgerald wrote a letter to Max Perkins in which he abruptly detoured from updates about his work in Hollywood to talk for 2 paragraphs about Gatsby. I think it's one of the saddest literary letters ever written. As often happens with Fitzgerald, though, there's also that eerie quality of prescience. This is Fitzgerald talking, and he makes reference to his daughter, Scotty, who's about to go to Vassar. I wish I was in print. It will be odd a year or so from now when Scotty assures her friends I was an author and finds that no book is procurable. Would the 25-cent press keep Gatsby in the public eye, or is the book unpopular? He puts that in italics. Has it had its chance? Would a popular reissue in that series with a preface, not by me, but by one of its admirers, I can maybe pick one, make it a favorite with classrooms, professors, lovers of English prose, anybody? But to die so completely and unjustly after having given so much, even now there is little published in American fiction that doesn't slightly bear my stamp. In a small way, I was an original. 6 months later, he's dead.
Maureen Corrigan reading from her new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. It is published by Little Brown. Let's talk about some of the themes of the book. Very much about fate, of mm-hmm, course. Mm-hmm. And we see this through many different facets, don't we?
I think Gatsby is both our most American novel and our most un-American novel at once. think about the image, which I think of as the signal image of this novel, it's not the eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. It's not really the green light. It's Gatsby reaching for that green light at the end of chapter one. The first time Nick Carraway sees Gatsby, he sees him out on the lawn at the end of his property, looking out across the Long Island Sound, and he's reaching out his arms to that green light at the end of Daisy's Dock. That image of reaching, of stretching out your arms farther, trying to go higher. I mean, that's the all-American image. That's the way we like to think of ourselves, right? And yet, at the same time, this is a book that tells us if you reach too far, you're going to go under. You're going to sink in the waves. You're going to fall in and drown. Like so much of American literature, Gatsby is obsessed with drowning images. It seems like that's our national nightmare, this fear of going under, of losing our footing and just falling beneath the waves. The amazing thing about Gatsby, one of the weirdest things, is that everything in the book has happened as of page one. This is Nick Carraway talking to us in 1924, looking back to the summer of 1922. So it's all in a retrospection. It's all happened already. Nothing can be changed. And that's such an un-American message because, again, we like to think of ourselves as people, you know, there's always a second chance. We can remake ourselves, transformation. Forget about it. Gatsby is dead when this novel opens.
Nick is telling us this story as the survivor,
yes,
really,
yeah.
Much like,
yeah, like Ishmael
and,
yeah,
and Moby Dick.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. He's the survivor of the wreck. He lives to tell the tale. And you get the impression that Nick is so possessed by this story. He's going to spend the rest of his life talking about that summer of 1922 and his time with Gatsby. But it's not a complete downer. I mean, if it were, we wouldn't be reading it in high schools. We wouldn't be rereading it as I do. And it wouldn't have been chosen for the big read project by the National Endowment for the Arts. Fitzgerald may say that the American dream is a mirage, but he writes about it in language that makes it irresistible. He may say that, you know, in reaching for that dream, Gatsby inevitably falls under the waves, but he writes about it in language that's so buoyant. My colleague at the Washington Post, Jonathan Yardley, once said that the last seven pages of The Great Gatsby contain the most beautiful language that anybody has ever written about America, and I think he's right. I don't think anything beats Gatsby.
When it comes to the drowning, but there's also the car crashes.
They're the
which are also very
much
a part of the...
Yeah, and that's why I say in the book, it's not as though Gatsby is a noir, film noir, and those stories don't happen until later, but it plays with a lot of the elements that will eventually be so important to films like Double Indemnity and Mildred Pierce and The Postman
voiceover.
Always. Yeah, the voiceover. We get Nick Carraway. It's basically a voiceover. Mm. What we get in Sunset Boulevard, the voiceover of a man who's pretty much dead himself, you know, kind of remembering the events that have made him the way he is, that have been so tragic. Cars. If any of you remember Double Indemnity with Barbara Stanwyck, you know that in film noir, in hard-boiled detective fiction, which is a product of the 1920s, it's always a bad sign if a woman is in the driver's seat. If a woman is behind the wheel, you know that out-of-control drives are about to happen. And of course, Daisy is behind the wheel. She's the one who runs over Myrtle Wilson. Gatsby is the poor sap who takes responsibility for it, but it's actually Daisy. This is a novel as transcendent as it is. It's also a novel of its time, of 1925. It's nervous about women, these women who've just gotten the vote and who are drinking and having sex and wearing short skirts. It's nervous about foreigners. It's nervous about dark-skinned people. It doesn't know what's going to happen to America. And so you know, there's a fair amount of politically incorrect commentary in Gatsby, along with all of this great language that survives the prejudices of its own time.
As we end our conversation, I want to just read the end of the novel and have you talk a little bit about it and how it ultimately sums up the book. Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past.
That's a statement about the doomed beauty of trying. You know, we all die. All of our efforts fall short. But isn't it beautiful to try? That's what those words say.
And that ultimately is why you believe, and I agree with you, that we keep coming back to it,
yeah.
Because there is that, we hope. And there is that trying aspect to it.
Yeah, there's an affirmation there.
And even optimism.
Yeah. And by the way, those lines, Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda are buried in St. Mary's Churchyard in Rockville, which is about a half an hour outside Washington, D.C. They're buried under a slab, which has the last lines of The Great Gatsby on it.
And that was the second time they were buried.
Oh, that was the second time, yes.
Because he's Catholic.
Yeah.
They don't let him be buried in the Catholic cemetery.
No. His father's family was from Maryland. When Fitzgerald died in 1940, his body is shipped back from California. The Catholic Archdiocese says that since Fitzgerald basically hadn't done his Easter duty for years, which is going to confession and receiving communion, that he could not be buried in the plot where his father and all of these ancestors were. So he's buried in a Protestant cemetery in the rain. The minister who buries him doesn't know who he is. And about 15 people show up. Does that sound familiar? It's Gatsby's funeral. It's one of the ways in which this very odd book looks forward and seems to predict Fitzgerald's own funeral. It's a book that also seems to predict the Great Depression on the horizon when all the lights in Gatsby's house go out in the third act of this novel. The Great National Party is about to go out too at the end of the 1920s. It's such an interesting book because it's almost though it's talking about things that Fitzgerald couldn't have known but seems to have sensed. Eventually, Scotty Fitzgerald, Scott and Zelda's daughter, got her parents moved in 1975. By then, the Catholic Church relented and allowed them to be buried together. It's amazing, though, how many people don't know he's there. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful spot. The church is a historic church. It was a site on the Underground Railroad. But it's about 12 inches from Rockville Pike, which is a major highway. Think Valley of Ashes scenery there. I don't know. I think it says something not so great about how America regards its artists, its writers. Why don't we have a Westminster Abbey? Why don't we have a spot where writers like Fitzgerald, and yes, even Hemingway, where we can go and pay our respects. We can doff our hats to them. He's buried in this churchyard, and so many people who teach with me at Georgetown don't even know he's there.
But you say that if you go there, people like leave little miniature
they
bottles
do. They
of,
do. The people,
of liquor.
Yeah. Which
is kind of cool.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, it wouldn't happen in Westminster Abbey, but it's still kind of cool.
Yeah, they leave liquor bottles. They leave stones, which is, you know, Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. You put the stone on the grave. They leave money, which I don't quite get.
That's a weird American thing.
They leave pens, a lot of ballpoint pens. They leave their own work. I guess they're waiting for Fitzgerald to say, let me put you in touch with Maxwell Perkins or something. I don't know. But that part of it is lovely that people don't know he's there, because you can go, as I've done many a time, and you're the only person in the churchyard. You know, I was raised Catholic, so I have a thing for talking to tombstones, and it you do have this sense of it's a special place.
Maureen Corrigan's new book is So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be Written and Why It Endures. It is published by Little Brown. Maureen Corrigan, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Saratoga Springs, New York, in partnership with Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.